But it was, maybe you can explain to us the process where it started, or how the change of politics and consequently the change of mentality started in America. That changes
But I'll go very fast over that because it's not the subject really. I mean, it begins in, if you want to start at the very beginning, it begins with one of your guys. It's Friedrich von Hayek. He goes to first to Cambridge, then to the University of Chicago. He founds the Mont Pelerin Society with the money coming from a right-wing foundation, the William Volcker Foundation. So 47 is the beginning. Then there's the Chicago Boys, Milton Friedman, and all these people who studied with Hayek. And then there is the uprising in the popular mind and the popular action in the U.S. in the 60s. And the right does not like the anti-war movement. They don't like the feminists. They don't like the gay liberation. They don't like any, racial justice. They don't like any of that. And so they are beginning to think about how they could change that general, boiling of society. And they are taking advice from intellectuals who are saying, look, you've got to go to the top of society and you have got to change ideas. And that is what these top foundations did. They invested in intellectuals, in publications, in writing books, in think tanks, in media appearances. They used money, management, marketing, and a lot of media. And they aimed at the universities. They aimed at any place where ideas are forged and then distributed and diffused, and they were very successful. They would fund anything from a scholarly colloquium with a quarterly journal right down to the campus newspaper. And a lot of right-wing speakers going around to colleges and changing people's minds, just gradually changing the mentality. I call them the right-wing Gramscians, because if you know the work of Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist thinker, he said that power really wasn't about oppression or about, you can't do it with brute force. You have to achieve cultural hegemony. You have to get the culture to agree with you. And to do that, you have to make what he calls the long march through the institutions. And those institutions include the universities, the courts, the media, even the family, even the church, etc. So that's how they did it.
I don't want to distract you from the money subject.
No, okay.
One of the questions is, of course, how to change this, this money pyramid. How would the left get the money to do?
Well, we haven't even discussed how the banks got it all. But let me go back to deregulation, because it's very important to understand that the banks and the financial industry lobbied, and you're quite right to say it's a lot of it during the Clinton administration, in order to get deregulation. And the first target that they had was a piece of legislation called the Glass-Steagall Act, after the two, the senator and the representative who sponsored the bill. The Glass-Steagall Act was one of the very first things that Roosevelt signed in 1933, and what it said was that the commercial banks have to be absolutely separate from the investment banks. A commercial bank is where you put your salary, where you write checks on your salary, you can get a loan there, but it deals with everyday things for individuals and small companies generally. An investment bank is very different because it doesn't make its profit out of loans and lending at a higher percent than it borrows, which is what a commercial bank does. It gets its money from fees because it is launching different stock operations, mergers and acquisitions. They sell bonds for the governments. Goldman Sachs, have you all heard of Goldman Sachs? It's the company we all know.
That's
and
what the American government is called nowadays.
Exactly, the company we all know and love. They are marketing United States Treasury bonds. And they're marketing more of those than ever before because the U.S. probably issued $3 trillion already this year in government paper. And every time somebody buys a large slice of that, Goldman Sachs is getting a fee. I think there should be a government agency to do that, but I was very surprised when I learned that. And Goldman Sachs is very happy because Lehman Brothers failed, and I don't think it is an accident that Henry Paulson was Treasury Secretary at the time that it was decided we will not save Lehman Brothers, and he just happened to be the former president of Goldman Sachs. But anyway, whatever the relationship, there's now much less competition. So they're marketing more Treasury bonds. Well, Glass-Steagall was scrapped. They had a hard time doing it. It took a dozen years, but they got it.
That was Clinton, wasn't it?
It was under Clinton. Yeah. And Robert Rubin, also a Goldman Sachs man. No, he was Citicorp at the time, but he had been at, I forget which one he was where, but anyway. The Citicorp really was the first to decide that they would merge with an insurance company anyway. That was illegal at the time. They merged with a commercial bank with a very large insurance and securities company. And they got a waiver from the Federal Reserve. And they said, well, within 2 years, we'll comply with whatever the provisions of the law are. But then they didn't have to, because they were betting that they could get the law abrogated before they had to comply. So they, as soon as they made that huge merger in 1998, everybody rushed into the breach and started making these huge mergers. And when you make these huge mergers, you become what is now called, in the United States, too big to fail. And so you know that the government is going to be the lender of last resort. If you are about to fail, you think, ha, who cares? You know, I can take risks because I know that Uncle Sam is there to take care of me.
When they let Lehman fail, yeah, the consequences were drastic for the whole world economy.
The consequences were drastic, but not for everyone. Once again, many people cashed in on that. The other very large investment banks, like Goldman Sachs, have done okay out of that. Now, smaller banks are still failing. We just hit the 99 mark in number of banks that have failed in the United States this year. And maybe since I've been in Vienna, there's been 100 failure. I don't know. But banks are still failing. And the government is supporting them. And the amazing figure of all the government guarantees, this is not what they have actually given the banks, but it is what they have guaranteed that in case of emergency they will give. And this comes from the U.S. Treasury watchdog, who Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, doesn't like at all. He would like this watchdog to be thrown out and to put out of his misery. But this watchdog says that the government has promised $23.7 trillion. This is twice the GNP of the United States right now. So that's impossible. But that is what the government has guaranteed in various programs to the banks and to the depositors. And what scares me is that I think we're going for another bubble now that we've had the dot-com bubble where all of the stocks in Silicon Valley collapsed, and then we had the housing bubble, which we could talk more about, in which housing prices collapsed and the subprime crisis hit, And now I think we can very well have a bubble in treasury paper. It can become as worthless as the paper for mortgages. I hope not, but...
And who is going to guarantee for them?
God. You know, my parents used to say...
We should start praying then.
My parents used to say, God takes care of little children, drunks, and the United States. Not anymore. I think...
I remember I did an interview with the Austrian Chancellor the other day, and I asked him, who's going to pay all this money that you gave to the banks that you won't get back, maybe? And he said, nobody's going to pay.
He said,
nobody's going to pay.
Nobody's going to pay. Well, I didn't believe it. I think that's a bit disingenuous, because as I understand it, about a year ago, they guaranteed or actually handed out 100 billion euros. Okay, you're 8 million Austrians. That means if that money doesn't come back, theoretically, you all owe, everyone, get out your wallets, because you all owe 12,500 euros right now. If that money doesn't come back, that's what you owe. Every Brit now owes, and that is money that has been given to the banks and is not going to come back, every Brit owes 4,000 and some pounds. I've got the figures somewhere. And they expect it will go up to 8,000 or 9,000 pounds. And I can't even tell you how much every American owes, because the figures are so different according to which guarantees and which figures you take. Some people say it's been 4 trillion. Others say it's up to 12. I don't know. But it's an awful lot.
And one of the usual solutions is inflation?
Well, there's only a certain point you can go to with inflation. And now the problem, now this is where I get a bit mixed up, and I don't know what's going to happen at all. And I would be interested if there are people in the audience who think they do know what's going to happen. Because there have been reports that the Japanese, the Chinese, the Europeans, and a few sheikdoms or oil producers have got together and have said, we are going to have a gradual conversion into a different money than the dollar for petroleum. And if the U.S. can no longer pay for its oil with money that it prints, which is very convenient, then they are in real trouble. But the paradox is that the Chinese now have 2 trillion and some in reserves, in dollars. And they don't, I mean, they're kind of caught, because they don't want that to become, you know, like toilet paper or something. So I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'm scared. And I think we should all be very, very scared.
When you described this money pyramid before, the obvious solution would be, and you also mentioned the 90% tax for the top taxpayers, then the obvious solution would be a just taxation system that would stop tax evasion, tax havens.
Absolutely.
And how do we achieve this?
How do we achieve that? Join a TAC. Everybody here. Or join something else that is allied with ATTAC. Because, no, I'm not saying everybody join ATTAC. I think it's a very good organization, but we can't do it alone in ATTAC. And I don't think anybody can do it alone. Or whatever your main concern is, I happen to be more frightened of climate change than of anything else at the moment. I think that's the one... it's the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced, and I say that very seriously. But I feel that workers cannot solve the problems of working people alone. Unions and even the Arbeiterkommune cannot solve the problems of working people by themselves. Ecologists can't solve the problems of the planet alone. ATTAC cannot solve the problems of international taxation alone. Women cannot solve problems of feminine specifically feminist problems alone, etc., etc. So that means we have to make alliances, because we will not force our governments to do any of these good things unless we do.
You didn't mention political parties. Have you lost your hope in them?
I never lose hope. But that's because I feel that life is full of surprises, and that sometimes small inputs into systems can make large changes. So I don't give up on political parties, and quite slowly I think things are building up on the left, but I am terribly disappointed in social democratic parties. That I have to say, because and you can see that I am not alone. No, I mean, they have, their philosophy seems to have been, let's copy what the right does. Well, if I give you a choice between the original and the copy, will you, you'll take the original. And one thing I used in this book I was speaking about earlier, Hijacking America, I contrasted the cover of Time magazine in 1965, where they named John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist. He'd already been dead for 20 years, but they named him the man of the year. And Time magazine, which is not at all a radical publication, right? It's very middle of the road. And they said, we are all Keynesians now. And they explained how Keynes was everywhere, and nobody would ever think of not using Keynesian policies, welfare state, you know, state spending, etc. And in 2002, so just about 40 years later, Peter Mandelson stands up in front of a Labour Party conference, but it's all the social democratic brass of Europe. It's all the dignitaries of all of the EU. President Clinton is there, and it's a very, you know, posh meeting of the social democrats of the world. And Mandelson stands up, and he says, we are all Thatcherites now. What kind of left person is that? I mean, how can you say in any way, shape, or form that you're on the left if you're saying we are all Thatcherites now? And what he meant by that, as far as I can tell, but I'm not in the mind, thank God, of Peter Mandelson, was that he said it sort of right after Lionel Jospin had lost the French elections. Well, I can tell you why Lionel Jospin lost the French elections. He lost the, he came in third, not because the extreme right was so strong, but because nobody on the left wanted to vote for him. And we all said, okay, I will go on the second round and I will vote for Jospin, because nobody believed, the polls didn't tell us Le Pen was going to come in second. I mean, maybe we should have known, but nobody wanted to vote for him because he had said, I'm not running a socialist campaign. He had privatized more than anybody. I mean, it was, so that's what I'm terribly disappointed in. And if they once more side with the with Baihu and with the center right, the same thing will happen to them that has happened in Italy and that just happened in Germany. I don't know enough about Austrian politics to know what's going on here, but I'm sure people in the audience will be happy to fill me in. But this is the error. This is the fundamental error. They have no courage.
Are you so much disappointed because I read in your book, the solution is socialism plus democracy? You don't see a
revolution. I'm not a social democrat. I think I'm a democratic socialist, I hope. I don't know. But no, what I don't believe in is labels. I do not trust people who know exactly what the future society should look like. All of the 20th century was carnage because they knew exactly what future society should look like. And they had a blueprint, and if you didn't agree, you were sent to the gulag or you were killed. And this is not on. So, yes, there can be a much better society. I don't believe in a utopia. I believe in a constant progress of emancipation. But I don't think that there is a set thing, and there shouldn't be. It will be different for different cultures, different histories, different people, different degrees of struggle. Lots of interesting things happening in Latin America, which would not probably fit in Europe. Ours will be different.
You also said, and that was several years ago, it was 5 years ago, I think, you said that if Europe doesn't take the leading role in the world and it will be successful with its model of social balance and democracy and civil liberties, then nobody can do it.
Well, I didn't say exactly that. I mean, that's how a lot of people understood it, so I probably was not being clear enough. What I said, I think, was I know that Europe has done absolutely horrible things. I mean, two huge world wars, the extermination of millions, colonialism, we've done the worst. But in some ways, we have also done the best. In other words, we invented trial by jury, habeas corpus, constitutions, human rights, political and civil rights, culture of a certain kind to which I am very attached. Let's just say we invented opera. Look at Vienna. I mean, you know, this is a huge contribution, in my view, to civilization. And we invented the welfare state. Now, we had the money to do it, but what I meant by that was that Europe has a unique, it had, because I fear that there I really have to speak in the past tense, had a unique opportunity to show the world that you could have a more egalitarian model, you could have a rights-based model, and you could have a democratic model of government. And they, of course, did not want democracy. The Commission doesn't want democracy. It wants an authoritarian kind of leadership. And as soon as France votes no and the Dutch vote no, they say, well, no means yes, and we will give you another treaty which is exactly the same as the one that you refused. And when the Irish say no, they say no means yes, and you must vote again on the Lisbon Treaty. So that's what we'll have, and we will have a non-democratic...
What's the alternative? A national
what's
state?
What's the alternative? The national,
we're still talking about regulation. That's what
yeah,
I have, well, that's what
the
I have
alternative
in
for Europe is to call a constitutional convention of elected representatives of all of the peoples of Europe who have been elected to write a constitution. I mean, for God's sake, we did that in 17... We did that in 1787 in the United States, and people came on horseback. Or I think we could do it, you know. In Europe, they could take the train.
They did it in Paris, too, but they had... We sent them a queen to behead, and they
yeah,
also had
well,
a king.
But the good thing about Europe is that we don't invade each other anymore. This is a very, you know,
so
considerable progress.
There's some
that's
credit
important.
You have to give to
no,
the
No, that's
European.
Very important. But I take that, maybe I shouldn't, but I take that as a given now. I mean, I say, okay, that's going to remain whether we have the commission or whether we have a much more democratic form of government. We're not going to start invading Spain, and you're not going to start invading us.
But talking about these regulations for taxation, for example, for
yes.
these 78,000 impressive yeah. Trillionaires, are they? Trillionaires.
Well, they're or, together.
Well,
they
together,
are.
They are.
Yeah, together they are. We don't have any trillionaires yet. That day may come, but so far we don't.
Somebody has to make laws.
Yep.
Somebody has to stand against international yep. corporations, multinational yep. corporations. National states won't be strong enough to do that, except when they're so big as the United States.
Yep. So
what's the alternative to the European Union?
Well, I don't say there's... I'm very European. I mean, I feel like a European, even though I was born in the U.S. And I want to be a European. I don't want this particular Europe. I think it could be a much better example to the world. But who can do it? Well, we could start in Europe with the Eurogroup, because the European Central Bank is never going to approve of a tax on the euro as a currency unless it is forced to do so. And the only people who can force it to do so are central bank governors of the Eurogroup, who so far have been behaving like, you know, they don't do anything.
Except keep inflation low.
Well, that's what, yeah, they keep in, the ECB, the European Central Bank, has one mandate, and that is to control inflation. But, I mean, come on, Jean-Claude Trichet, who is a perfect product of the French higher education system, which is to say that he has very little imagination, probably great technical skill, but very little imagination. And this man actually raised interest rates in July of 2008. Everyone else in the entire world was lowering interest rates because that was one way of fighting the financial crisis and trying to keep credit markets a little bit liquid. And Trichet raises them. So, anyway, this is not one of my favorite people. But what can happen, but we're only at the beginning of it, is that we start taxing financial transactions. And I could explain that this would be good for everybody. It would even be good for the banks, because they would probably move out of that, which is a quite low profit activity, even though there's 3.2 trillion traded every day on currency markets. They would probably move into activities that were more profitable for them. Now, whether that's a good or a bad thing is neither here nor there, but you can't say it would be bad for the banks. You could do this very easily. There are no technical problems to it. You could collect it at the European Central Bank. Well, actually, it would be collected in New York through a complicated system, or no, not even a very complicated system, which is called the permanent or the constant, I have to look it up, I forget the name of it, but it's a clearing system that handles 95% of all the currency transactions in the world.
It will be collected
automatically. Four lines of software, it's no problem. You don't have to have a law in every country. You just have to say the euro from now on, every transaction in euros will be taxed at one basis point or one-tenth of a basis point. I don't care whether it's one per thousand or one per 5,000. The point is to start international taxation. And that is what they're resisting. It's the same with income tax in the United States and everywhere else in the early 1900s. They all screamed because they said, this is confiscating my wealth, I have a right to use my money the way I want to. And of course they screamed, because they knew that it was putting the foot in the door, that they could, after that, it would be 1%, you know, it would be 1%, but then it could go up. Indeed, they were right, because it did go up to 90% on the top slice of income. And that's what the traders and the banks don't want. The principle of international taxation is scary for them.
So you think you should start by taxing transactions, but then you also have to, there's not only tax havens, there's, as you said before, if you have the right lawyers and you don't pay taxes.
Well, we should certainly close the tax havens. And the G20 did start talking about that, because there was a big popular movement in Germany, in France also, I mean, there was quite, in Britain even, and now they're not talking about it anymore, but that is something, there's a very good organization called the Tax Justice Network that does nothing but this kind of work. There's also, it's perfectly simple technically, to tax transnational corporations, which are paying less and less every year. Some of them pay nothing. Citicorp, for instance, has 400 subsidiaries in tax havens. They have, you know, a lot of those are in the Cayman Islands. There's all kinds of ways you can avoid taxes. But the G20 so far, I mean, they did something ridiculous. in their first meeting. They said there are four non-compliant countries which nobody thought of, especially as tax havens. You know, there was the Philippines and Uruguay and no Cayman Islands, no Bermuda, no Virgin Islands, no Jersey, no. And then the next day they were all off the list and nobody talked about it anymore. International taxation is a very important point.
There's another thing I wanted to ask. I know I'm keeping you from...
And then we can maybe let the audience talk.
Yeah, right. But just in connection with this tax question, is how do you explain... In one of your books, I found an expression that I like very much, something like public wrath.
I'm sorry?
Public wrath. Or public scorn, whatever you would translate. Wrath. Public wrath.
Anger.
Yeah, anger, right. Public, why don't people, after the subprime crisis, they lose everything?
Yeah.
Or in cases where they invest in banks that go bankrupt or have investment schemes that don't work, people lose their money, why don't they get angry?
I wish I knew. I think they're still scared. The pension fund of the California Public Employees, called CalPERS, is, I think, the biggest pension fund in the world. They are, right now, in court. They say that they lost $1 billion. That's the money that belongs to the public service workers of California. They lost $1 billion. Why? Because they believed what the ratings agencies told them. I have to explain a bit. The ratings agencies are private companies which basically rate investments, and they go from AAA down through AA+, and then AA, and then A+, and right down to the Bs and through to the junk bonds. But a AAA from one of these agencies means it's safe. If you're a widow or an orphan, you can invest and you don't have any worries. And this is what the ratings agencies were saying about what I call toxic sausage slices that the banks were selling, which were all based on debt, and a lot of it on subprime debt, but some on supposedly more reliable debt. But nobody knew what was in these sausages. They'd been mixed up and there were different things in different sausages, but they'd sold the slices on. And CalPERS was told by the ratings agencies, it's perfectly safe. Now they're in court and they're trying to get their money back one way or another. And when I learned this, I mean, I should have known it, but I was absolutely floored. In the United States, a corporation is a person. It's like a human being. These are corporations, so they are persons. A person has a guaranteed constitutional right to freedom of speech and freedom of opinion. The courts so far have always ruled that the ratings agencies giving a AAA is an opinion. And therefore, CalPERS could believe it or not believe it, it was their fault. And they paid. I mean, the ratings agencies are paid by the banks whose securities they are rating. Now, this may seem a bit dodgy, right? Or the corporations who are issuing bonds. It's not a very good incentive to say, I'll pay you, but give me a AAA. And I was once on television with a guy, I was in France and he was in New York, and he was the chief economist of one of these ratings agencies, and I said, don't you think it's a bad incentive to be paid by the people whose securities you are rating? And he said, well, yes, they pay us, but they don't pay us very much. And I thought that was rather weak, as an argument. But anyway, CalPERS so far has lost $1 billion of its own employees' money.
No,
and this
no
is
revolution.
Happening all over the place.
No revolution, though.
Well, why aren't the California public system workers in the streets? The university professors are not going to be paid. You know, I mean, the state is basically bankrupt. Well, you know more about that than I do. Why aren't the workers in the streets? Why aren't you there with Greenpeace and all the? This is beginning to happen. I mean, there in Britain, I was just in England Saturday, and for the G20, they had a huge coalition. The unions, Unite, Unison, the teachers' union, everybody is in it, and it's with the War on Want, all the NGOs that deal with the third world, a lot of women's organizations, even Save the Children is in this coalition, and there are huge marches, and this is starting to happen. It's very encouraging. But that's what we have to work on, is alliances, because we can't do it alone.
So we
let the audience talk.
I think it's time for questions. Anyone?
You said you don't believe in utopias. I'd like to make one comment on a green utopia, and that's a book called Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach. In this book, Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach, everybody who has been clever enough to make a lot of money then retires and relaxes, and this is even a sort of law. I don't know if you know that book, but maybe that would be an idea. If somebody has made, say, 100 times as much as the average person, then he or she should retire and no longer strive after even more. But what is probably more to the point is you mentioned international transactions, and I understand that ATTAC, the abbreviation of ATTAC, actually refers to international transactions, and you are a leading figure, leading personality in it. Could you tell me why the Tobin tax cannot be implemented, although one of the most conservative fossils in Austrian politics, an arch conservative named Schüssel, even he praised the idea of the Tobin tax on one occasion. Now, I'm not sure whether that was a mistake, but he did it. And so I ask myself, it would be easy to imply, and it's probably along your lines, and you probably have more experience than I do, why this can't happen. I would like to ask you one other question, and now I'm playing the devil's advocate. You said the little man in the street, so to speak, wouldn't really have been so affected by a complete breakdown of the banks. Now, I'm one of those little men in the street. You said because they were insured anyway. But would have paid for that insurance? It would again have been the government. It was one of those reckless guarantees that you mentioned. So we would probably, the taxpayer, would probably have had to pay for our bailout.
That's a very good set of questions. I think that there is one debate that we haven't ever had on the left. We haven't had it anywhere, but we haven't had it particularly on the left. And that is, should there not be ceilings on income? We know all about poverty lines. We don't know anything about wealth lines. So that today in the United States, the CEO, the chief executive officer of a corporation, is making 400 or 500 times as much as his average worker. Now, I don't know what the figure ought to be, but it seems to me that we ought to debate, can't there be a ceiling on remunerations? I don't think I would recommend that people retire if they have earned much more, because, you know, once you retire, you're dead, more or less. And I think that's... No, but I mean, if you're not active, if you don't have a really good... I've seen this happen, and I hope I never retire, you know, because... Anyway, should it be 20 to 1? Should it be 10 to 1? Should it be 50 to 1? I don't know, and I wouldn't decide that. But I think we should really have a debate about limits on accumulation. So that is on your question about remuneration. The little man has suffered very much from this crisis. These are the first people to lose their jobs. The ILO, the International Labour Organization, is issuing reports every 6 months or so, and every time they issue one, it says our last predictions on jobs lost were not accurate. It was much worse than we thought. And this has been going on for 18 months now, that it has always been worse. So the poorest people lose their jobs first, and in fact the immigrants lose their jobs before anybody else. So this also has an impact on the South, because a lot of places count on remittances going from northern immigrant workers to southern communities. So, you know, when unemployment reaches 9-10%, this is very serious. And we already had 79 million poor people in Europe, according to the European poverty line. So this has certainly gone much beyond that. Yes, please.
I was talking about
the bank deposits. Well, the bank deposits would have been paid by a fund in the U.S., which is the place I know about. I don't know European laws in this, which is called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And, yes, that would have come out of taxes, but it would have been inferior to the amounts that the banks have received, I think. I haven't, you know, made up the figures, but it would, you wouldn't have to bail out as many banks unless you had allowed the largest ones to become too big to fail. If you had kept them regulated, you know that these banks were allowed to not put the losses on their balance sheets. That is crazy. They could make losses and then put them in the shadow banking. They didn't even have to declare them. They were taking huge risks. I didn't talk about leverage at all, but I would. Can I talk about leverage? I'd love to. I'd love to talk about leverage. The risks these guys were taking. Let me explain what leverage is. Let's say you have 1,000 euros to invest. And someone comes to you and says, I have a really good investment for you. And at the end, and you can get 10%. And at the end of the year, you will have 1,100 euros. And you think, great. But then you think that would be really stupid. Because if I borrow, I can make much more. So I borrow 9,000 to add to my 1,000. So now I have 10. At the end of the year, I have 1,000 euros and not 100. I pay back the loan to the bank at 5%. So I pay the bank 450 euros and I have 550. So I've made 55% on the money that was actually mine. And if you borrow 19,000 to make 20, and then if you borrow 29,000 to make 30, you can go up to 200% on your money, you know, 250%. Very nice system. So long as the markets are going up, it works. And some of these banks were leveraged, Lehman Brothers among them, were leveraged at 33-1, 35-1. In other words, they had borrowed $32 for every dollar they actually had on hand. But they didn't have to respect the capital requirements, which were supposedly 8%. You were supposed to have at least 8% of the risks that you were taking elsewhere, but they didn't. They had far more risk than that because they were so highly leveraged and because they were not obliged to stop this crazy business because they weren't regulated. So we're in the realm of if this, then that, but there have always been bank failures and people have been paid back, but massive failures of very large merged banks, which are both commercial and investment banks, and huge, that is because they wanted it that way. because that's how they made so much money. So if you don't allow that to happen, you don't have the problem that you present of the little person, or you have it so occasionally that it doesn't make that much difference.
So I have two questions. The first is countries in the South, in Latin America, have now created their own system of money that it's calling sucre. And I would like to hear from you what mm-hmm. your opinion is in confrontation to the dollar, mm-hmm. maybe also to the euro. Mm-hmm. And the second one is the question of the so-called ordinary people. Of course, we know that the weakest parts of our society, that is social, that is education, that is ecology, they will suffer much more than the other parts when the state has reduced his subsidies or any other things. So, and I quite actual as now since a few days, the university in Vienna is occupied, and in some other countries there are similar actions. Mm-hmm. So that's not only the question of some bad conditions within the universities, but it is also generally on the question of how to finance the education system. So that's the question, mm-hmm. How can we start this movement that mm-hmm. you already have favorized?
There was a gentleman over there.
My name's Joe Offenberg, and I think that because of the overall question was where has all the money gone, much, much emphasis has been put on the old system and how to fix it for one or the other reason. Yeah. Have you ever thought of going completely different ways? Couldn't it be a good chance of walking away? There is a good saying in English, to walk away with the feet. If only 5% of the people get rid of the old system, not trying to fix it, leave them alone, the capitalists. Mm. Yeah? If they try to put on their own thing, I think there could be much done. For example, Bernd Litayer, Miss Kennedy, you know, alternative monies, regional monies, taking care of this could be probably much effective. I would like to have mm-hmm. your answer on this, please.
Thank you. And there was a last question here.
Yeah, my name is Amaiso, Dr. Amaiso. I'm working mainly on financial crisis, so I'm quite aware about the issue. And I was very impressed about your explanation. But let me be very frank. Do you think that the maximization of profit as it goes right now should not be changed for maximization of value, in fact, human value? This is an approach that some African development banks are working on right now. The second issue is about poverty. The financial crisis right now creates a system where you have economic growth but no job. How long can this sustain? Third point you mentioned about deregulation. This is something which is hitting Africa very badly in terms of poverty and various other issues. The problem for Africa now is that they may not work anymore often with Western countries, but with Asian or eventually Latin American countries, China, for instance. Mm-hmm. They are not different. They are taking raw material. The point I want to make is that if this goes on, the way it's right now going on, do you think that within 5 to 7 years, because of the toxic assets which were not solved right now, and our taxpayers' money has not paid for that, do you think we are going to have another financial crisis?
Thank you, everybody. And Susan, may I ask you to just sum up everything in one final speech, and then...
No, I'm sorry. You can't ask me.
Yes, you must.
You can't ask me to do that because they're too diverse. I'll be as quick as I can, though. Yes, I think it's very good to have alternative money, and the souk is a good idea, and any other currency which becomes prominent, a regional one or a even a local one. In London, they've started an alternative currency in Brixton, for instance, which has already got quite a lot of members. And the LET system, the local exchange trading systems, are one way of avoiding participating completely in the capitalist money economy. Another way is to form cooperatives to buy your food from local farmers. We call them AMAPs in French, but they exist in other places. There's lots of ways to relocalize production and consumption. You can't do it with everything, but you can do it with a good part of your... And in Austria, actually, there was a system that incorporated thousands of people in the 30s, I think.
The 20s and 30s.
So that maybe should be studied and perhaps revived. I don't know the local situation. The universities, as far as I understand it, I agree that higher education should be free. I would not be here tonight if I had not been able to have free education after my first degree, for which my parents paid a lot in the U.S., I was able to do a licence and then a doctorate in France, even though I had three children to bring up, because it didn't cost anything. So I wouldn't be here tonight without free education. So I think it's absolutely important that people who are qualified should be able to continue as far as they can continue. Now, as I understand it, because in Germany the universities are paying, that there were 25,000 German students who came to Austria last year. Now, this is a country of 8 million people with amenities, which are always ranks very high in all of the surveys, right behind the Scandinavians. Austria is one of the more successful societies in the world. But can a country of 8 million people provide services for a country of over 70 million people if they choose to come here? That I'm not at all sure of. And I think that this question has got to be tackled. Completely walking away from the economy, that's hard. You can do it in some areas. We mentioned currencies, but I think that what we have to do now is a complete conversion, a Green New Deal, massive investment in an ecological conversion. And if some people can walk away and live with very little, okay, fine, I have nothing against it. But I believe we have to scale up enormously if we're going to save civilization. It's as simple as that. Right now, we are in the system, and this is the third question, and it has to do with the 78,000 people and the power question. We are now living in a society, if you think of it, as a series of concentric circles. Finance is on the outside. It's the most powerful. Then comes the economy, but finance is dictating to the economy, and the real economy is suffering because of finance. Then you have society. Finance and the economy determine how society is going to function. That's what happens in a capitalist system. Society then, as it is now organized, simply takes the raw materials from the environment, which is the smallest circle in the way we order our affairs, and takes its raw materials and dumps its wastes, including its CO2. And I believe that the system should be exactly the opposite, and it is a question of power, and that it should be the environment first, because that is the reality. You cannot win the war. If you make war on nature, you are not going to win. You will be annihilated. And the only thing left will be a very few people and the crows, the cockroaches, the rats, the flies, and the mosquitoes, which can adapt. So ecology first, then society, organizing the economy in a way that serves human beings, families, and people. And finally, finance is a tool, one among many tools that the economy can use. We will always need to finance things in some way. We will always need production, consumption, and investment, and it's how you organize those things that counts. And I think that what's really important is not to say capitalism or socialism or have those old divisions. I believe that the real debate is what should be in the market and what shouldn't. And I don't think credit, for example, should be in the market. I think credit should be a public good. And I think banks should be public utilities. Now, maybe we will need another crisis for anybody to think seriously about this, but that is... And the power question is the one that I have tried already to answer by saying that unless we make alliances and take those alliances seriously and include as many people as we can, we won't win because the 78,000 don't want it and the bankers don't want it and so on. But if you look at your concerns, if you are a worker, you have this circle of concerns, and I'm not a manual worker, I'm a knowledge worker. And I have slightly different concerns. So my concerns are here and yours are here, but there is a place where they overlap. Huh? There is that arc in the middle where they overlap. And we should be building on those overlapping spaces where we can agree and see what can we build on that politically and how can we make a better world doing that. The problems of Africa, the perennial problems of Africa. Africa has been badly hurt by the IMF, the World Bank, by structural adjustment over the years. Unfortunately, I have to report that there are also, there's a very interesting new study done by two economists at the University of Massachusetts, which shows that over the last 30 years or so in 45 countries, I think they took African countries, that the loans that were coming in, 60% of those loans left the country the same year and were deposited in private accounts, in tax havens, and so on. And in that way, about $420 billion left Africa. And if you add the interest, it's $600 billion that were not invested in African development. Now, my answer to that is, did the IMF know this? If they did, they were complicit in the crime of theft. Did they not know it? Well, in that case, they were incompetent. But I don't think that there is a third term. Yes, Africa is now working with China. China is taking huge tracts of land in many places. I do not think that they are doing that in order to grow food for Africans. I think the Chinese are very foresighted, and that Africans may regret very much that they gave large concessions to the Chinese, but that's in the future. And yes, I think we are going to have another financial crisis, a very brief answer to a complicated question. Middle Eastern banker, very interesting what you said. I agree also that the U.S. is accelerating the crisis. They didn't start it, but they certainly got a new twist on it. How to terminate capital accumulation? I don't know any other remedy besides law. I think, you know, the banks, first of all, have got to be got under control. You can call it nationalizing them, you can call it socializing them, you can call it what you like, but they have to be required by law to loan to small and medium enterprise, to loan to families. I think I spoke about that before. And in order to facilitate a green conversion and a social conversion, they should loan to enterprises that have a social project, a more democratic way of organizing production and consumption. So I don't know any other way than legally. I don't believe that we're going to have a one-off worldwide revolution. I'm sorry. I only see the way of doing that through law, and for me, democracy is the only way, because every other system has led to unspeakable horrors.
Political scientist and author Susan George, speaking in Vienna last October on Where Did the Money Go? Thank you for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. You can download this and all previous programs at unwelcomeguests.org in the archive.